Ghost Hunting in New England,
your favorite spooky podcast.
Hello and happy Wednesday. Welcome to this week's episode of Ghost Hunting in New England with your hosts, Amelia.
And Beth.
Why did you wait three beats for the Beth?
Because when I edit the podcast, I notice that you say hello and happy Wednesday, blah, 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 where it's you, Amelia. And I jump on immediately and go, and Beth, very excitedly. Like, I just couldn't wait to say my name.
I love it.
So this time I waited and I tried to play it cool.
All right. We'll see how it sounds this week.
Because we do things that are cool and interesting.
I'm very happy we're doing something exciting and interesting today because it is snowing nonstop. I feel like every day I look outside and there is more snow and I can't stand it. Make it stop.
Why can't you stand the snow?
I don't like the snow at all. First of all, I don't like driving in the snow.
I don't think you like driving in general.
I really enjoy driving. I love driving. I don't like driving at night and I don't like driving in the snow because my eyeballs are not great. And in the snow, the light reflects into my eyes and makes it hard for me to see. And at night, I can't.
They have these new, there's a new invention that will help with that. I wear them all the time. It's called sunglasses. I wear them when it's cloudy out. I wear them when it's snowing. It helps a lot. I'm not being a wise guy either. All right. I started off as a wise guy, but
you
now
were being a wise guy. You were being a wise guy.
Now I'm being serious.
Anyway, what I need is I need my real glasses. I'm not really supposed to drive at night because I don't have my glasses right now. So I don't drive at night.
Do you have a B restriction on your license?
I don't know.
Oh, then you don't need your glasses to drive at night.
Well, I do if I don't want to crash into things.
No, please don't drive at night.
Thank you. Paul usually drives me. I you know, the snow, it's very cold. It's very wet. It's bad for my business and I can't stand it. I like going on nice long walks. I don't love doing that in the snow. I like sitting in the sun. I can't really do that in the snow. I'm a creature of the forest. I don't like doing that in the snow. So I don't like the snow. And that's my story. And interestingly enough, it's not interesting at all, actually. It's quite boring. But the only times I've left my apartment this week, pretending it's not snowing with Miss Beth Ellen here as we've been going tanning and to go fall out pretending it's not winter, we got burned to a crisp. And Beth and I pretty much talk all day, every day when we're not on the show, just in general. And we have shared so, I feel like so many photos are just like, look at my sunburn. And then you send me one back. God bless you because you have been way more sunburned than I have. But it has been painful. Oh my goodness.
Well, so that's the thing. Like my sunburn, it's not painful. Or maybe you're a wimp. I don't know.
No, mine's very painful. I've had to like wake up in the middle of the night because I'm already awake and like put aloe on and then try to go back to bed.
I mean, mine's a little itchy right now, but nothing really.
Well, anyway, once we heal up, we're going back at it. We're gonna conquer those tanning beds and just summer in our minds, summer in our hearts.
No. See, in the summer, I stay in the shade and in the air conditioning. This is solely for Amelia's wedding, so I don't look like a ghost standing there next to her. Those black and white photos that you see of Amelia and I on the social media from time to time are not really black and white. I am literally that pale all the time. Amelia, for some reason, is dancing, and I don't know why. She's like, it's like pseudo belly dancing. But
I like watching myself on camera. And as you may know, our listeners might not, I took 4 years of belly dance classes, so I actually do know how to belly dance. I'm pretty good at it. Anyway, okay, moving on. So today we're talking about something really cool and interesting other than belly dancing and tanning, and that is
the snow,
which is never cool or interesting. But we are talking about haunted jails. In fact, we went broad. We started out as haunted jails. We're talking about haunted jails, haunted penitentiaries, haunted correctional facilities, the whole gambit. So I think this is going to be just fascinating, Beth.
So we were going to start with the entire history of the penal system here in the United States. No. We're not going to do that.
Actually, we are in one of my stories. As a matter of fact, Beth, we are.
Seriously?
Yeah.
All right. You talk. I'm going to go make a sandwich. I'll be back in, what, like 10 minutes?
No, you're the one who always likes the history. So it'll be fun. I cut a lot of it out.
Well, I'll listen from the other room, but.
Well, that's why I sent you a text earlier today that was like, how long are your stories? Because I was on page like 6 of writing out history of mine. And I cut it back a lot. Okay. So Beth, would you like to regale us with our first interesting story about haunted jails?
Sure. So one of the things that you didn't mention about our haunted jail theme is prison camps. I am actually going to talk about a prison camp here in Rutland, Massachusetts. Ooh. So I wanted to talk about this one because usually the places that we talk about that are haunted, you can't just go and check them out. They're usually on like closed down pieces of property that the state owns that have been condemned, and you can't go in there, you know, without being arrested or charged with trespassing or any of that. But the Rutland Prison Camp is in the Rutland State Forest. It's about 15 minutes west of Worcester, which is not pronounced anything like it looks like on paper. So good luck finding that one. The Rutland Prison Camp was built in 1903, and it wasn't a prison or a jail so much. I mean, it was, because at that time being an alcoholic was sort of kind of a crime. And so it was populated by alcoholics who needed something to do with their time other than drink. So what they did at the prison camp was they actually developed a self-sustaining farm. It's like 150 acres that they farmed primarily for potatoes, but they also had chickens, vegetables, goats, and they sold milk and eggs. And they farmed enough potatoes that they were able to feed the entire prison system of Massachusetts, which is pretty impressive when you think about it. So it was all going well until about 1907. When they built a tuberculosis hospital right next door on the same grounds. And so you can refer back to our episode in season 3 about the progression of tuberculosis hospitals throughout Massachusetts. But needless to say, the nonviolent offenders, the alcoholics who were there starting in 1903, were really kind of turned upside down in 1907 when people who were hardened violent criminals throughout the Massachusetts prison system were all sent out to the Rutland Prison Camp Tuberculosis Hospital.
Question, why were they sent there?
Why were who sent there?
The hardened criminals.
Because they had tuberculosis, and in order to protect the rest of the prison population from also getting tuberculosis, if they had a prisoner who had tuberculosis, they would be sent, and they were then imprisoned over in the TB hospital.
I was confused. That's thought it was just like a TB hospital, and I'm like, what does that have to do with anything? But it's a TB hospital for criminals.
Yes. Okay. Specifically for the prisoners of Massachusetts.
Okay.
Okay. So you can go out there. It is open to visitors. All that's really left at this point is some cement columns that are covered with graffiti. There's some tunnels here and there that you can kind of check out. It was closed in 1934. They had some very sudden and unexplained complications with the water supply. And so without warning, really, everybody just left the prison one day, left the TB hospital, left the prison camp, and they were gone. So also on the grounds is a cemetery where there were 59 inmates buried. And so you can still go to the cemetery and you can, there's an arch noting. So remember when we went up to the Danvers State Hospital with Jamie? There was that little cemetery down the path, but you really had to know where it was, and there wasn't really any marking for it at all. So this cemetery is very clearly marked as this is a cemetery, and I'm not sure if there are gravestones actually in the cemetery itself, but you know that that's what this area is. So you can go down there, and you can walk around and check the whole thing out. It's supposed to be a really nice sort of nature walk for you there, creature of the forest. Is that what you called yourself?
Yes. I often enjoy a good haunted cemetery in the middle of the woods. So
it
sounds just like right up my path.
I would think that the former Rutland prison camp should be on your list of places to visit in the upcoming.
Absolutely.
Spring. Right.
Yes. Well, you
know, when you're not wedding planning and opening 4 new businesses and, you know, all the other crap
and moving
that you
and everything
do.
Else.
Oh yeah. And moving and, you know, helping your folks. And, okay. So, there were two sort of ghost stories that I came across when it came to this one. The first one is that the grounds themselves are actually haunted by the wife of a former warden. And she, of course, nobody knows what her name is. Nobody knows what year it was, you know, your typical. So naturally, the wife of the former warden, as she is haunting the grounds, is she appears out of nowhere. Guess what she's dressed in?
All white.
Oh, absolutely. All white, big white dress, flows all over the place. And then as soon as people start to notice her or get close to her, what does she do?
She gives them a high five and a ham sandwich.
Oh, absolutely. Right after she disappears into nothing.
Ooh. Right.
So it's your typical woman in white out in the middle of the woods. She tends to appear around dusk. And so you can go out there during the day. I believe that it is frowned upon for visitors to go out there at night. It's not necessarily a safe location. So that's one of the stories. The other one is courtesy of the Seven Hills Ghost Hunters and Paranormal Researchers of Worcester. And they're, like I said, about 15 minutes away. And so they go out, and the lead guy from their organization, I thought this was so interesting. He uses a Raggedy Ann doll as part of his ghost hunting equipment. He has all the regular stuff, the K2s, the EMFs, the spirit boxes, blah, blah, blah. But he uses this Raggedy Ann doll with an EMF reader in the hands, because he thinks that women and children who have passed over already are more comfortable interacting with the Raggedy Ann doll than they would be interacting with just random electronic equipment throughout the room. So he'll be talking to things, and like the Raggedy Ann hands light up, which I thought was really neat. So he was able to get some positive responses to some questions that he was asking. And he discovered that one of the spirits that haunts that area's name is Rose. So I wonder if Rose is actually the warden's wife who's haunting the space. And you know how usually we have these stories of like terrible things that happen to people while they're there, you know, even if it's something like people are getting touched by the spirits, or, you know, like there's screaming, or there's, you know, doors banging, or any of that. None of that seems to happen at this location. It's just very sort of quiet area. And this ghost just happens to show up and walk around, and her name may or may not be Rose.
Cool.
Yeah, so I thought that this was kind of neat. So yeah, it's
that guy on the show.
We should get that guy on the show.
Yeah, I'd be interested to hear about his stories with his doll.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Maybe he can give Will some tips if he's collecting haunted dolls. I don't think that the Raggedy Ann doll itself is haunted.
No, I don't think so either. But if he's still using it, then he's probably gotten something out of it.
Yeah. He talked a bit in the article that I was reading about his own approach to ghost hunting, and he does some things that you and I also do, those things about like when we're leaving, we always let the ghosts know that we are leaving and they cannot come with us. He's like, that's really important. He's like, you don't want somebody tagging along. And he said that he also does this thing, and I'd never thought of doing something like this, but on his way home from a ghost hunt, before he gets to his house, he always stops at like a convenience store or a supermarket or something with a lot of aisles, so that he can walk up and down the aisles to kind of throw the spirit off from following him. I just thought it was a really interesting idea.
Yeah.
So maybe next time after we're done with a ghost hunt, we should go and stroll through a 7-Eleven and pick up some gum.
There you go.
So that's my story about the Rutland prison camp.
Well, that was a very nice story.
Yeah. And I like your idea about booking the guy from Seven Hills Ghost Hunters. Let's see if we can hear his stories. Yeah.
I haven't heard of that group. If you're listening, reach out to us, because
yeah,
or we'll find you.
Oh, we'll definitely go find them. That's someone else. Yeah, reach out to us if you like.
Okay. So my first story is of the old jail in Barnstable, Massachusetts. And I specifically chose this story for Beth because I think she's going to really like it.
Ooh.
Are you familiar at all with the historic colonial jail in Barnstable, Massachusetts, Beth?
I am not, but I know that our aunt lived in Barnstable for a long, long time.
Yeah.
That's my connection to Barnstable.
Okay.
Perhaps if you tell the story, it'll be familiar, but
probably not, but I think you're going to like it.
Okay. I'm going to turn my microphone off and just let you talk.
Thanks.
Okay.
Built in 1690, Barnstable Old Jail, sometimes spelled G-A-O-L, is apparently that's how they used to spell it, is the oldest wooden jail in the United States of America. The jail served as Barnstable County Jail until 1820, when a new stone jail was built. The structure, which held about 6 prisoners, was eventually attached to a barn. In 1968, it was rediscovered. I don't know what that means by it was rediscovered, but it was rediscovered and separated from the barn and moved 100 feet onto the grounds of the Coast Guard Heritage Museum in Barnstable Village. The building was listed on the National Register of Historic Places in 1971 and included in the Old King Highway Historic District in 1987. So way back in the 1700s, the jail housed the two survivors of Pirate Sam Bellamy's flagship Wyda Galley, which wrecked in Wellfleet, and the seven survivors of his consort ship, Mary Ann, which wrecked 10 miles south of Pawtucket Island. The jailhouse is considered one of the most haunted jails in all of America and is open to ghost tours during certain times of the year. And it most famously is believed to be haunted by Goody Hallett, a.k.a. Mary Hallett, possibly Maria Hallett, a.k.a. the Witch of Wellfleet. So here's a little backstory about Black Sam Bellamy the Pirate and the Witch of Wellfleet. Full disclosure, I borrowed a lot of this from the Kinlan Grover Real Estate webpage, which for some reason wrote a blog post about this. They had a lot of good information about it, and so I got a lot of information from there. So Samuel Bellamy was born in Devon, England in 1689. Bellamy left his home for a life at sea at an early age before making his way to Cape Cod in the early 1700s. In the tiny Cape Cod village of Wellfleet, the young Bellamy met his true love, a blonde teenage beauty named Maria Goody Hallett. The young couple soon became inseparable, taking strolls across the dunes where they talked about getting married and raising a family in their picturesque oceanside community, where a man with a strong knowledge of the sea could support his wife and children through fishing. Bellamy had worked on rigged ships for several years and strived to become a prosperous sea captain. Goody's father, however, believed that his beautiful daughter had more promising prospects for marriage and haunted Sam's ambitions. Bellamy was soon driven out of Wellfleet by the elder Hallett, who told him, "Leave this place and never return." Sam Bellamy did leave, but not before making a promise to his love that he would come back to her a wealthy man and build the life both had dreamed of together. He sailed from Cape Cod to Florida, where he tried to earn a living by salvaging treasure from a Spanish silver fleet. This proved to be hard work with little return, as other treasure hunters had taken much of the booty before Bellamy had arrived. With no other options to provide him the riches he needed to marry his love, Bellamy joined a band of pirates led by the infamous buccaneer Benjamin Hornigold and the soon-to-be-famous first mate, Edward Blackbeard Teach. Sam Bellamy earned the name Black Sam for his refusal to wear the customary fashionable powdered wig. Instead, he let his black hair grow long enough to tie with a satin bow. Black Sam soon earned the respect of his fellow pirates, who voted to depose Hornigold as their captain for his refusal to attack ships waving the British flag.
You know, I don't ever think of pirates as being democratic. I think that they're more
this
autocratic.
This is pre-pirate.
Oh, this is pre-pirate. Are you
this
sure?
This is pre-pirate.
Okay.
Okay. The crew chose Bellamy as their new captain, and they began to successfully seize ships through several epic battles on the high seas. See? Now we're getting into it.
Okay.
In just over a year, Black Sam Bellamy and his men captured a record 53 ships. That's crazy.
That's a lot of ship. That's a lot of booty.
That's a ship a week.
Yeah.
That's crazy. His kindness and mercy to his prisoners earned him another nickname, the Prince of Pirates. His crew
He sounds like one of those pirates that you would find in a romance novel.
Indeed.
Yeah.
In fact, there has been a romance novel written about this.
Seriously?
Yes. I didn't include it in my story, but I did read about it while I was...
I was going to say, have you read this story?
No, I just found it online. His crew compared him to Robin Hood, and they called themselves Robin Hood's Merry Men.
No, they didn't.
Yes, they did. In 1717, Black Sam Bellamy captured his biggest ship ever, the Wyda Galley, which was filled with precious coins and jewels. But the Prince of Pirates still longed to be a good husband and a good father. 2 months after seizing the Wyda, he turned the ship north and set sail for Cape Cod and his one true love, Maria, but sometimes known as Mary, Goody Hallett. While Black Sam Bellamy had been away at sea, his love Goody discovered that she was with child, which is an old-timey way of saying she was pregnant. And here's where the story takes a very sad turn. She doesn't die, though, just a heads up. Okay. So she was a child. The fact that she was not married sparked a scandal in her small village. The town elders brought Goody to the local meeting house where they voted to banish her from the community.
She had to wear the scarlet letter, didn't she? Like Hester Prynne.
She didn't even get a scarlet letter. They were just like, get out.
Wow. That was really like the lady who went and started Rhode Island. Why can't I think of her name?
And I don't know.
And something or other.
Don't know. Okay. So like Black Sam before her, Goody was forced to leave Wellfleet Village in shame. She moved closer to the ocean and became a recluse as she watched the horizon day after day in hopes of her lover's return. In April 1717, Sam Bellamy found his way home to the Cape, but the calm weather he and his crew had enjoyed during most of their journey suddenly turned when they entered the waters off of Cape Cod. Bellamy and his crew and the Wyatt found themselves caught in a violent gale just 500 feet from shore, just 500 feet from his love who watched from the cliffs. Just after the clock struck midnight on April 26, strong winds thrust the ship into a sandbar in only 16 feet of water, a true shallow grave for any seaman. The widest sturdy mast snapped in half at the point of impact, and the heavily loaded ship capsized in the frothing surf. 143 pirates drowned, and only 2 survived. The body of Black Sam Bellamy was never found. On the night of the storm, villagers spotted Goody on top of the bluff, watching in horror as the ship went down. Some later said she shouted into the wind, cursing the storm for taking her lover. Others insisted that she became a witch and created the storm herself through sorcery as an act of revenge against the man who left her and had shamed her in the eyes of her family. Those who believe this legend also say that the villagers chased Hallett, who had later become known as the Witch of Wellfleet, with torches and pitchforks into nearby swamp where she died. Others claim still that Hallett reached the Wyatt by rowboat and searched desperately for her lover. Unable to find Black Sam, Goody loaded the boat with treasure and buried it deep in the dunes of Wellfleet, along the trails where she and Bellamy had charted their future together. The story of Black Sam Bellamy lay dormant for centuries beneath the icy waters off of Cape Cod until the year 1984, when an American underwater explorer named Barry Clifford discovered the wreckage of the flagship Wyatt. And at the time of its capture in 1770, the Wyatt carried more than 30,000 pounds of sterling and massive amounts of gold, ivory, and indigo, making it the largest pirate booty ever collected. In 1984, a team of divers led by treasure hunter Barry Clifford dove onto the wreck, and it was the first authentic pirate ship wreck ever discovered in North America, which is kind of cool. Mm-hmm. And much of the treasure and 200,000 artifacts were recovered from the shipwreck. This is back in the 80s. And now they're on display at the museums around the United States and sponsored by the National Geographic Society. Kind of cool, right?
So I wonder if those 200,000 artifacts, like each coin was an artifact.
I don't know.
I would think they had to be. How could you get that many artifacts on a ship?
I don't know. But what else is interesting about this is, so this happened a very long time ago, right? So this is in the 1717 is when the ship wrecked. So there's all this talk about Maria and, you know, maybe Mary, and this is why she's maybe Mary, is because historians have kind of tracked this story back in time. Because for a long time, it was thought just to be like kind of a tall tale, like a fictional story, but then they found the pirate ship. And then they found at the time the ship went down, there was an unmarried woman named Mary Hallett living in the area, and she would have been 19 when Bellamy died. And when that woman died in 1750s, she was a Congregationalist at that time. And so as they all did when they died, they gave away all of their worldly possessions. So she gave everything away and she was just buried in a shawl with one exception. And that was, she asked to be buried with a solid gold necklace that had small gold beads on it. And historians think that that gold came from the pirate Black Sam Bellamy.
Neat.
Isn't that nice? So Goody and Black Sam are said to haunt the Expedition Wyandot, which is now in Provincetown, as well as what is called Lucifer Land, which is an area on top of the Wellfleet Cliffs. And they also are said, so she is said to haunt the jail. And I found in a lot of places it says she haunted the jail. And I found in a lot of places that the jail is where the two survivors of the shipwreck lived. But I couldn't figure out why she would have haunted the jail. And what I kind of like in my mind is we kind of like make up this, and I'm like looking at all the history, and then I'm looking at like all the stuff the ghost people are saying, is maybe she was like visiting the two survivors to like find out information. And for some reason she stayed there. I couldn't find anything that said she had been arrested. One account said she had stayed in the jail for some time, but I couldn't find out why. But apparently
for being an unwed pregnant woman in the 1700s, that would have been enough to get you jailed.
Well, she wasn't jailed though. She was shunned.
Perhaps as part of the shunning, that was the only place where she could stay.
Maybe, but I mean, I don't know. So the point is she apparently haunts it. And so the jail is haunted by her and apparently some other people. And everyone says it's like one of the most haunted places. So haunted, in fact, it is now under, I don't believe they own it, but it's under like conservatorship, or they take care of it. And that is the Cape and Island Paranormal Research Society now cares for the jail.
Okay.
And they got the town's permission to have them be the caretakers. And they run haunted ghost tours, Bonstable Haunted Tour. And that goes every summer, which is also run by the Cape and Islands Paranormal Research Society. And it kind of ends at the old jail. Mm-hmm. And so that's where they kind of go in and do their final talking. So, you know, lights will go on and off, and you'll hear like thuds and bumps and, you know, other kinds of things in the night. And so that is the story of Goody Hallett, Pirate Black Sam, and the old jail in Barnstable, Massachusetts.
Very nice.
Thank you.
I have to say, I don't find that story to be familiar. So that was kind of neat.
I thought you'd like it because it was a nice little sea story.
Yeah. Amelia knows me. I love everything to do with boats.
Yeah.
So my next story is just slightly outside of New England. It's in Warwick, New York, and it is the Mid-Orange Correctional Facility. So the reason that I suggested that we do a whole episode on jails of New England is because tours of the haunted Mid-Orange Correctional Facility were popping up on my Facebook feed for months. Every other ad was come and see this ghost tour at the Mid-Orange Correctional Facility. And so I was like, oh, well, you know, I can probably do a little bit of research on that and see what's going on there. One of the things I found in trying to research it is there's very little available information on the hauntings going on there. And everything that I could find was about take the tour, come on our tour, come see the haunted place. We have a tour. We'll have a psychic. There'll be a medium. You can do this. You can do that. It's $150. Like, so.
Whoa. Oh my goodness.
Right. To join a group of people to go in. Right. Like usually these tours are what, like, you know, $20 and you go walk around with a group of people. Like $150 is a little extreme, but you know.
Do you stay overnight?
I think that it is more of an extended like overnight sort of thing. And you get the whole facility like to yourself and your tour group. It's not like.
Do they make you breakfast?
I don't recall seeing anything about that. Mm. Although now that you mention it, I think that there was mention of like drinks and snacks.
Hey.
Which as I read it, I did think was kind of odd to include as here's one of the perks of going that there'd be a psychic. There'll be, you know, all of these, you'll have private time with all of our different machinery and, you know, all of our instruments and we'll provide
my kind of ghost tour, bougie.
Well, they'll have snacks too. So $150 and you can go to the Mid-Orange Correctional Facility ghost tour.
Get some crackers. Yum.
Mm, and maybe a tab. They even still make tab. Do you know what tab is?
I thought you meant a tab like a drink tab. No, I do know what it is, but I don't believe they make it anymore.
It's for our young viewers.
For our younger listeners.
Right. It's a soda pop. Or if you're from New England, it's a tonic. It was one of the old style. Was it a diet soda?
I have no idea.
I feel like it was like women who were in like aerobics videos would drink Tab. So
when I think of like Tab, I think of like a thin woman with a Tab in one hand and a Virginia Slim in the other. Okay. I feel it's like from that era.
Yeah.
With big hair and Virginia Slims.
All right. So the Mid-Orange Correctional Facility was opened in the mid-1930s. It was actually opened as a school for troubled boys. So young men who could not be served by the local schools due to violent behavior and persistent behavioral issues were shipped off to the correctional facility where they were given their education. And there was a lot of, as you can imagine, abuse and neglect that went on there. Eleanor Roosevelt actually visited that site in the 1940s, 50s, and said that it was just absolutely horrendous. And so it became kind of the impetus for changing about some of the things that were going on with these institutional settings for young men during the mid-century. In 1976, it was converted over to a men's prison, an adult men's prison, where it remained a men's prison until it closed in 2011. So one of the more famous residents that they had was a man named Richard Biegenwald. He was the Jersey Shore thrill killer in I think it was like the late 50s to the mid 80s. He was killing all sorts of people up and down New Jersey and New York. And so he ended up here in the Mid-Orange Correctional Facility. But he had actually started living there when he was 8 years old. He had been sentenced there as a child. And so there's some thought that those traumatic experiences for him paired with his later return to the facility as an adult might have resulted in his spirit being stuck there. And so he's thought to be one of the spirits that haunts the place. One of the fun stories that I did find about this was something called Jordan Matter and the Ballerinas. So Jordan Matter is a photographer, I believe, out of New York, and he had taken this group of ballerinas after the facility was closed, and they were going to do a photo shoot there and do a little, you know, ghost hunting stuff. They had an official ghost hunter with them. And so some of the things that they saw, Amelia's laughing at me.
No, photographers are just nuts.
Oh, okay.
They're just crazy people. Like, oh, we're going to just take some ballerinas into this like old haunted prison and we're going to do a big shoot. We're going to have a ghost hunter and it's going to be great. And then we'll start a ghost tour. We'll serve wine. Okay. Anyway, it doesn't matter. Charge $150.
That might have been what happened. So some of the highlights of their trip, all right, was that they saw a man, the shadow of a man, hanging on the window bars, looking out at them, and then he disappeared. All right. So two of the four ballerinas who were there saw that. While two of the ballerinas were looking at the disappearing man on the bars, two other ballerinas were a couple of cells down the row and had some tingly touching going on the back of their legs and the back of their feet. And so just that very sort of creepy, like, what is touching me? So as they were kind of moving around separate from each other, there was out of nowhere this blood-curdling scream, which everybody thought that somebody else in the group had made that scream, but there was nobody alone in the group at the time. And everybody could vouch that nobody that they were with was making that screaming noise. So just out of nowhere, horrific screams. Mm-hmm. Jordan Matter, the photographer, also brought his son on the ghost trip. His son said that he was touched on the back of his head as they were walking up a set of stairs. And it wasn't like a violent touch, but it was more like almost like paternal sort of tap on the head sort of touch. But yeah, there was nobody else there, and it was very upsetting. They had a phasma box, and it caught some voices talking to them. One of the things that they caught very clearly on the phasma box was a "help me" coming over and over. And that was also picked up on a voice recorder that they had running in another room. And they didn't actually hear that "help me" on the voice recorder until later on when they got home and they were listening to all the recordings together. So that was definitely a little freaky. So then they have the A3 building. It's one of the other buildings on the complex. And they decided that they were going to hide a mystery box in the A3 building. And the ballerinas were going to have to go in there and try to get the box. I don't know what, if it was part of the photo shoot or part of the ghost hunt or part of both of them. I'm not entirely sure. But at this
point, if a photographer invites you somewhere weird, ladies, say no. Say no. You can go to a studio. This guy sounds like a pervert. How old were these ballerinas?
Probably young teenagers. I don't know. It doesn't mention.
I don't like this. All right. I mean, I like your story, but I.
Well, this is important though, because all of the ballerinas' parents were there as well. Like they weren't inside the building, okay, but they were there, because this is the next part of my story, that when they got to the A3 building, one of the ballerinas just became so frightened and overcome that the ghost hunter that was with them had to actually escort her outside to her parents. She was so upset. So while they were here in the A3 building, there were reports that someone grabbed or something grabbed one of the people's arm, like a violent grab. And if that wasn't bad enough, someone else was choked by an unseen spirit, just hands around the neck, just being choked until they could finally like get her outside.
Yeah, that's not good. And
yeah. So one of the ballerinas was brave enough to crawl through this absolutely horrible tunnel. And what have we learned about tunnels in some of these haunted locations? Like, no, like they're definitely not going to be fun. So only the ballerina and the cameraman crawled through this really long, really skanky, like really awful tunnel that smelled like sewerage. And it was just horrible. And they found the mystery box on the other side. And she said that when she picked up the box, they could see a ghost standing in the room with them. And so they very quickly backed right into the tunnel and scooted all the way back through into the other room. So there was like $1,000 in cash or so in the box. And, you know, just
this guy's a pervert. This is screwed up. I'm sorry. I'm taking a hard stand on this. If this guy's listening to the show, reach out and we can talk about it if I'm wrong, but I don't think I am. Like, you have a bunch of, their parents are there, so they're adolescents, and you're making them crawl through some haunted place with like camera guys and like some ghost guy, and oh come on little girl, go find the $1,000, and fuck that, and shame on their parents too. Sorry.
These and more other authentic reactions by Amelia on this week's episode of Ghost Hunting in New England.
I don't agree with it.
So anyway, that was sort of the big story that I was able to find about the Mid-Orange Correctional Facility. And I think that, you know, being a grown woman myself, and I would probably plan to not go with some weird photographer.
Unless it was me.
I was just about to say, like, you are a weird photographer. We could probably go, and, you know, if we could get somebody to sponsor us for the $300 to go take the tour, you know, we'd love to report back to people. You know, if you want to go and you're willing to pony up the $150, just Google it by all means. Every single site that comes up will be all about how you can pay a company to take you in there. Yeah, I thought that was a really sort of interesting story.
It's a fun one.
I also don't approve of taking those girls into the correctional facility, but whatever.
Oy vey. All right. My next story.
It's one of those episodes, Amelia.
It is.
All right. What do you got?
All right. My next story is the Eastern State Penitentiary in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania.
Oh, really? I thought you were going to do the one in New Hampshire.
No.
Oh, okay. Cool. All right. Take it away.
No, I'm doing the one in Philadelphia, which is not New England, but it's very haunted and quite interesting. Okay. Most of the historic backstory I got from this story, I got from Smithsonian Magazine. Are you allowed to plagiarize if you say that you're about to get all your information from there?
No. Plagiarizing is when you take someone else's words and you put them as you make it out like they're your own. Citing,
I am citing
information, is literally what you did, and that's how you avoid plagiarizing.
Yeah. So I do that quite a bit in our stories. So I am now citing, as I did cite the real estate agent in the last story. This time I'm citing the Smithsonian Magazine. Okay. So in 1787, 4 years after the American Revolutionary War, the United States was a country brimming with possibility. And no city felt the excitement more than Philadelphia. Delegates such as Alexander Hamilton and James Madison were gathering at Independence Hall to draft what would later become the Constitution. That same year.
Wait, we need to sing some sort of patriotic song here.
God bless America, land that I love. All right. So that same year, a couple blocks away from Independence Hall, at the home of Benjamin Franklin, another group of civic-minded leaders gathered to debate a wholly different matter. Prison reform. Conditions at the Walnut Street Jail, located directly behind Independence Hall, were appalling. Men and women, adults and children, thieves and murderers were jailed together in disease-ridden, dirty pens where rape and robbery were common occurrences. Jailers made little effort to protect the prisoners from each other. Instead, they sold the prisoners alcohol, up to nearly 20 gallons of it at a day. Food, heat, and clothing came at a price. It wasn't unusual for prisoners to die from cold and starvation. A group of concerned citizens, calling themselves the Philadelphia Society for Alleviating the Miseries of Public Prisons, quite the name, decided that this must not continue. What they would propose set the stage for prison reform, not only in Pennsylvania, but also the world over. Dr. Benjamin Rush, a prominent Philadelphia physician with an interest in politics, in 1776, he served in the Second Continental Congress and signed the Declaration of Independence. More than a decade later, he would lead the push for ratification of the federal constitution. He was an outspoken abolitionist and would later earn the title of the Father of American Psychiatry for his groundbreaking observations about diseases of the mind. In 1787, Rush began proclaiming to his contemporaries, including but not limited to Benjamin Franklin, that a radical change was needed, not just at the jail on Walnut Street, but the whole world over. He was convinced that crime was a moral disease and suggested a house of repentance where prisoners could meditate on their crimes, experience spiritual remorse, and undergo rehabilitation. This method would later be called the Pennsylvania system and the institution a penitentiary. The Philadelphia Society for Alleviating the Miseries of Public Prisons, also known as the Pennsylvania Prison Society, agreed and set out to convince the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. Changes were made to the Walnut Street Jail. Inmates were segregated by sex and crime, vocational workshops were instituted to occupy prisoners' time, and much of the abusive behavior was abolished. But it wasn't enough. Philadelphia's population was growing by leaps and bounds, and so was the criminal element. A prison of a grander scale was needed to fulfill the prison society's mission. For repentance to truly happen, the complete isolation of each prisoner would need to occur, and this was impossible to do in the overcrowded jails. Construction of Eastern State Penitentiary began on Cherry Orchard outside of Philadelphia in 1822. The chosen design, created by British-born architect John Haviland, was unlike any seen before. Several wings of individual cell blocks radiated from the central hub. The penitentiary opened in 1829, 7 years before the completion, but the institution proved to be a technical marvel, with central heating, flush toilets, and shower baths in each private cell. The penitentiary boasted luxuries that not even President Andrew Jackson could enjoy at the White House. Charles William, a farmer sentenced to 2 years for theft, would be inmate number one. On October 23rd, 1829, Williams was escorted into the new prison with an eyeless hood placed over his head. This was done to secure his anonymity and eventual integration into society upon release, as no one would recognize his face from the prison. But it also served another purpose. To ensure that there would be no chance to escape, Williams would never see the prison beyond his private cell. Communication with guards was done through a small feeding hole. The inmates lived in complete isolation, their Bible the only possession, and chores like shoemaking and weaving to occupy their time. Delegates from around the world came to study the famous Pennsylvania system in more than 300 prisons throughout Europe, South America, Russia, China, and Japan would be based on the Eastern State Penitentiary model, but some not so convinced of the method. Charles Dickens, after his visit in 1842, wrote critically, "I am persuaded that those who designed this system do not know what they are doing. I hold the slow and daily tampering with the mysteries of the brain to be immeasurably worse than any torture of the body." And as it would turn out, Dickens was correct. So, in 1913, Eastern State gave up on the Pennsylvania system of isolation. Prisoners now shared cells, worked together, and even played organized sports. The jail had been originally meant to house approximately 300 criminals, but by the early 20th century, housed over 2,000. And it was determined that the previous idea of solitary confinement had become less about repentance and more about punishment. By the 1960s, Eastern State Penitentiary was falling apart. In 1971, it was officially closed by the state of Pennsylvania. And over the course of the 142 years the penitentiary had been opened, it held 75,000 inmates, including the gangster Al Capone. It was declared a national landmark in 1965, and the prison was opened as a historic site in 1994. Today, tourists can walk beneath the vaulted ceilings and skylights of the neo-Gothic building that once represented the moral ambitions of the America's founding fathers. They also have ghost tours and a virtual tour on their website and a gift store and lots of fun things you can do there. In fact, when I was doing research on this, I told my darling fiance Pavel about it, and he is from just outside of Philadelphia, and he was like, "Oh, in Philadelphia, they do ghost stuff there every Halloween." I was like, cool. Okay.
There's nothing quite like a prison gift shop.
I know, right? Okay. So that's a lot of fun history. And I know you like history, Beth, and that was quite a bit of it. And I cut out a lot of what I had previously. But that is a good amount of history. But here's some stuff that I found on some other websites, including NPR and other reputable news sites. So this isn't just like down the ghost rabbit hole. This is like real reporting done on this. And let's just say it outlines the torture a little clearer. Some of which included what is known as the water bath. Inmates were dunked and then hung out on the wall in the winter until ice formed along their skin. The mad chair, which bound inmates so tightly to their chair that the circulation was cut off and often led to severe amputations inside the walls of the prison. The iron gag, in which an inmate's hands were tied behind its back and strapped to an iron collar inside the mouth so that any movement caused the tongue to tear and bleed profusely. The hole, a dank underground cell where the unfortunate souls had no light and no human contact, no exercise, no toilet, and barely any food or air. Although executions were not carried out at Eastern State, the prison was home to its fair share of murders. At least two guards were murdered over the years, as were many inmates. Hundreds of others died of disease and old age. As previously mentioned, Eastern State's most famous, perhaps infamous, inmate was Chicago gangster Al Capone. From 1929 to 1930, Capone served 8 months for carrying a concealed and deadly weapon. So it was not uncommon at that time for gangsters to have the nicest cell in any prison, and that was true at Eastern State as well. Capone's furnishings included a desk, a lamp, paintings, and a cabinet radio. He complained, however, during his incarceration that there was one other thing in his cell with him, and that was the ghost of James Clark, one of the victims of the St. Valentine's Day massacre in Chicago.
That's crazy that a ghost that Capone killed would have followed him all those states away to just haunt him. So this goes to what Tenney likes to talk about the person is haunted.
Exactly, yes.
Yeah, that's crazy.
Yes. So as I'm sure most of our listeners know, the massacre was a result of gang rivalry, and Capone led one side of it. Solitary confinement even plays in the minds of history's most notorious criminals. Because when Capone was there, he had all this stuff, but he was still in isolation. So other hauntings include cell block 12, which is known for echoing voices and crackling. Cell block 6 for shadowy figures darting along each of the walls. Cell block 4 for visions of ghostly faces. Many people have reported seeing silhouettes of a guard in one of the towers, footsteps, wails, whispers. And most importantly, it all seems to be the same stories over and over. One of the most legendary tales comes from a gentleman named Gary Johnson, who helped maintain crumbling old locks at the prison. In the early 1990s, he had just opened an old lock at cell block 4 when he says a force gripped him so tightly he was unable to move. He described negative, horrible energy that exploded out of the cell. He said tormented faces appeared on the cell walls and that one in particular beckoned to him. The prison has also made its way into multiple spooky television shows, including but not limited to Travel Channel's Ghost Adventures and Most Haunted Live, Sci-Fi's Ghost Hunters, and MTV's Fear. Dozens of paranormal visitors visit each and every year and report that it's a hub of otherworldly activity. They also have lots of cool events, like they have a zombie walk that goes on there and like all other kinds of cool things. Like they really go all out. It looks like a lot of fun. I'm very excited to go.
Yeah, I just want to point out, remember when we went and did the USS Salem with Don DeCristofaro?
Yes.
So remember how he was talking about when they put on the haunted house on an actual haunted ship, how it just kind of aggravated all the ghosts on there?
Yes.
So I wonder if that's something else that's happening at Eastern State Penitentiary is because they keep putting on like the zombie walk or these different Halloween events. Is that just annoying the ghosts that are already there and really kind of like kicking up the activity right around that time? And
could be.
Yeah. Very cool and interesting to go and investigate.
Well, I was just going to say, Beth, that, you know, this is not set in stone. And things could change. But right now it's looking like most likely I will be living about 20 minutes away from here by Halloween.
Mm.
So you'll have to come down and we can go investigate.
Yeah, maybe.
Why? Maybe not. You just said you want to investigate it.
Oh, I do, but maybe not at Halloween. Want to hear my last story?
Sure.
Would there be an episode of Ghost Hunting New England that was complete without mention of Salem, Massachusetts?
I mean, there's been like 35 of them, but a lot of them do have mention of Salem. A lot of them do. Hey, you're right. You got something going there. A lot of them do.
I'm just trying to, you know, like build the mood here. So this is my last story of the night. This is the Old Salem Jail, obviously located in Salem, Massachusetts. It is at 50 St. Peter Street, and it is built on the site of where Giles Corey was pressed to death.
Ooh.
So it's already got some bad mojo and some bad energy going on there. It was actually the first official jail that was built in the New World, was built right on this site, which to me was just crazy. Like, how is it that there weren't other jails? But then why would there have been other jails? Salem was a pretty early settlement. So the Old Salem Jail is kind of like the colloquial name for it. The official name for it is the Essex County Correctional Institute. So again, it's been around since the late 1600s. It's gone through a number of different renovations, obviously. Interestingly enough, though, it did not have widespread indoor plumbing until the 1970s.
Oh, my goodness.
So before that, inmates had to use 5-gallon buckets as their like chamber pots and would have to clean them on a regular basis. There were two like live working plumbed toilets in the entire facility until
that would be a deterrent for me to do crime.
Because you don't want to poop in a bucket?
Yeah.
In front of other people?
Just in general. I mean, you know, I always wanted to like be one of those people who lived in the redwood trees so that way people couldn't tear them down. But you have to poop in a bucket and like send it down to other people. And I was like, too much for me.
Wow. You're really like hippie crunchy, aren't you?
Yeah, Beth. We've known each other 31 years. You know this about me.
Yeah, I know. But that kind of surprises me that you would draw the line at pooping in a bucket.
And giving it to someone? Yeah. No, thanks. And I'm kind of scared of heights.
See,
but
that makes
the pooping in the bucket, that was the big thing, yeah.
Oh, okay. Anyway, so they only had two toilets in the whole facility that were plumbed, and each inmate could use one of these live toilets once a week. So with any luck, you timed it just right so that you could poop in a toilet. Sorry. I found this to be one of the more amazing things that I found out about this jail.
It's wild. It's crazy.
All right. So it was closed in 1991. The inmates were moved off to different correctional facilities in the area. And then it really stood vacant until 2001. When it was closed in 1991, the inmates who were there absolutely trashed the place. Like they ripped down walls. Have you ever watched? Never mind. I'm not even going to go there. So anyway.
Have I ever watched what?
Beverly Hills 90210.
No.
Okay. So you wouldn't get it.
I was too old. No, I was too young.
You were much too young. They play it on reruns now, and I think you can get it on Hulu.
Cool.
So anyway, in 2001, the city of Salem, tired of this decrepit, vacant thing sitting there that was just attracting vandals and teenagers and smoking and all sorts of other terrible things, bought it for the grand sum of $1.
Nice.
And they were hoping that developers would come in and make something out of the space. And so it took a little while, but a developer finally came in with like a $10 million project that they were going to build there. Luxury apartments. There were going to be, I think, 22 of them. And the first day that they put those apartments up for bid, 17 of them were immediately taken. So people didn't seem to care that it was this haunted location and that their apartments were going to have trouble and...
I feel like in Salem, that would be a draw.
Perhaps.
Like, you know, I don't want to, I mean, I wouldn't do this because I'm a good Christian woman. But, you know, if maybe I wasn't, if I had like, you know, oh no, I have like 50 apartments I need to get rid of in Salem. I'd be like, you know, this place is haunted, right? Damn. Oh.
So, 17 of them got snapped up right that day. And so rent in them at the time ran between $1,000 a month and $2,900 a month, which I think back in, you know, like the early 2000s, that's nothing for rent now in the New England area or in the Boston area anyway, that you would be very hard pressed to find an apartment for less than $2,500 a month.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the $1,000 a month people really got a deal. Anyway, yeah. So they are luxury apartments now at this point. I guess there's a little like storefront area underneath them with the apartments upstairs. And so you can still go to the location and you can sometimes see some of the creepy stuff that still goes on. So some of the things that people...
I have a question. Is it still an apartment complex?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Interestingly enough, it's two blocks from Pentagram. So some of the things that people have seen happening there, this is when the old jail was still standing, was that lights would flicker despite there being no electricity actually hooked up to the building. And so I was thinking about this actually, and I'm like, well, there was a problem with, you know, like homeless people living in it. There were, you know, all sorts of other problems. Like those lights flickering could have been something as simple as somebody lighting a cigarette or if there was a little fire going on. So I don't know about the lights flickering. What I do think is more likely, there were screams coming from no one day and night. And shadow people are seen lurking around in both the old jail site and then after that building was torn down. There are still shadow people seen in the area to this day. So there are some questions about who are these ghosts, right? And so I have some definite suggestions. So one of them is a man named Albert DeSalvo. He is a serial killer. So in June of 1962, a little guy named the Boston Strangler came to the public attention. And he started breaking into women's apartments, or somehow he was very good at getting himself let into the apartments. And then he would strangle women with their nylons. So if you needed another reason not to wear nylons, as though there would be, you know, like you need another reason other than the fact that
they're not comfortable, they fall down, they rip.
Right. Like they're horrible things. Apparently lots of people got strangled to death with them. In fact, 8 women were strangled with their nylons, and he stabbed to death 5 other women. He was finally identified in 1964. He had impersonated a detective to get into a woman's apartment, raped her, and then left. And she identified him later. He was imprisoned in the Old Salem jail, where he confessed to a cellmate that he was actually the Boston Strangler. That's how he got caught. And the cellmate reported the confession to the cellmate's lawyer, who was a slightly famous guy named F. Lee Bailey. Yeah. All these like little names that pop up. Speaking of F. Lee Bailey, did you watch The People versus O.J. Simpson from FX?
No.
Oh my God, it was so good. You have to watch it.
I'll check it out.
Yeah. He ended up being sentenced to life in prison in 1967, but he was sent to Bridgewater State Hospital as opposed to one of the correctional institutes. So he was in a psychiatric hospital. He did escape at one point. He was recaptured and he was found stabbed to death in 1973. So some people think that Albert DeSalvo's spirit and ghost were kind of like tied to the Old Salem jail because he had spent that bit of time there. And that's where it was discovered that he was the Boston Strangler.
Ooh, spooky.
There are also reports of people seeing full body apparitions running across the front lawn area. And so it's thought that maybe those are the ghosts of escapees who may or may not have been shot as they attempted to escape the area. So there were three escapes, that I got a little bit of information about. The first one was in 1891. A man named Charles Duncan was reported having just wrestled a guard to the ground, beat him up, and escaped. He walked off. There was another 4-man escape in 1947. That was another incident of they had, you know, assaulted a guard and they ended up tying him up, throwing him off somewhere. And they ran and jumped in a getaway car. All four men were later recaptured and brought back to prison. And then this was my favorite one. I couldn't get any information on what year this was, but I called it the Shawshank style escape. These 3 guys in a cell dug a hole in the wall and covered it over with a poster. You saw The Shawshank Redemption, right?
No, but it's one of my dad's favorite movies, so I'm familiar with it. He's told me about it.
Don't tell him that you haven't seen it. He's going to know.
I said he's told me about it.
Oh, yeah.
My dad really likes that movie.
It's a great movie. Sean and his dad used to go on and on about how it was so much better than Titanic, and there's no way that Titanic should have won the Oscar that year, that Shawshank was such a better picture, and blah, blah, blah. If you haven't seen The Shawshank Redemption, you definitely should. It's a great Stephen King story adapted. And it's, I think, the only story that I say that the movie version was better than the book version. Like, that's how highly I can recommend The Shawshank Redemption movie. It's fabulous. Anyway, so...
What about Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory?
I liked the book better. I didn't care for the movie. I didn't like the imagery that the movie had. The book's imagery was better in my head. Anyway, so yeah, they dug this hole in the wall. They covered it up with a poster. And when the time was right, they went through the wall. And then it wasn't the big thing where like they crawl through the big pipe like in Shawshank Redemption. But instead, they used toothpaste and they actually like cemented the bricks back in place. So it took a long time for anybody to figure out how they get out of there. You know, but then somebody came along and kind of like pushed on the bricks and was like, wait a second, it just fell right out, right? And this is I don't know how they figured out it was toothpaste. I mean, somebody's got to taste it to figure it out, but and I don't know. I'm probably not going to be tasting anything I find in a prison cell, but anyway, so
not even a 5-gallon bucket. Oh god, sorry.
That was disgusting.
I'm sorry.
All right. So the last one that is a possible culprit of these spirit hauntings is Confederate soldiers, because they were imprisoned here during the Civil War. And so there are lots of reports of shadow figures that are seen walking in front of windows. And the most disturbing of this is somebody reported that they were outside watching a shadow figure walk back and forth in front of a window. that the floor below that window had collapsed years before that. So like they were looking at somebody in a fifth floor window, but there wasn't a fifth floor for the person to be walking on. And I believe there also wasn't like a fourth floor, like the floors had collapsed down. So
Whoa.
There was no way that a person could be up there walking. There was nothing for them to walk on. Cool. So I thought that was kind of creepy. Men are seen in the area in the 19th century battle uniforms that you would have seen during the Civil War. And many, similar to Al Capone's story from the Eastern State Penitentiary, many Old Salem Jail inmates claim to have shared space with long dead inmates.
Mm.
So yeah, just craziness. So you can still go out there, and if you're lucky, you can catch a glimpse of something creepy happening on the new grounds. And yeah, and if you don't, just take a walk over to Pentagram and go see Tim and Leanne and get yourself a reading and maybe buy a fun book.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's my story.
Great story, Bob.
Hey, thanks.
That was fun.
It was. Did we get any mail this week?
Nope.
People. Where's our mail?
It's crazy to me.
Nobody has anything to say to us.
We have more listeners than we have ever had right now in the history of this show. We are up to 34 listeners an episode, and we get no mail. We get no more 5-star reviews. We get nothing.
She's totally serious about those 34 listeners.
It's just, it's 34. I can name like 32 of them off my hands. I know at least 6 of those haven't left us a 5-star review. So, yeah, I know.
Wow.
I know.
Let's,
it's rude.
We should start going to people's houses. We'll start knocking on their doors and taking their phones and putting in the 5-star review for them.
There we go.
No mail. No 5-star review. Mm-mm. No drive-by ghosting.
Mm-mm. The only thing I have to say is, remember last week we got that letter from Lindsay, and I read it on the show. We got it as we were recording.
Yeah.
I went on Facebook to respond to her, and I can't, and I don't know why. It will not allow me to respond to that message. I made a post about it on our Facebook. I don't know if she saw it. But Lindsay, if you're listening, obviously we got your message, and we're not rude people. We do respond to all of our messages. But
she might have her thing set up that only her friends can message her.
I don't know. Well, that doesn't make sense because she messaged us first. I don't know why I can't respond to it. I did download the book. I just haven't listened to it yet though, but I do plan to. So thank you for that.
Cool.
Oh, I have some other exciting news too.
Mm-hmm.
It is my goal by the end of this week to start updating our website again.
Oh, yeah. Remember how you were like looking to hire someone to do that?
No. Did I say I was going to hire someone to do that?
Yeah.
Do you have someone for me to hire to do that?
Oh, I could definitely get you some. I could definitely have somebody.
I mean, I have all the scripts for everything I've done saved on my computer.
Okay.
I get through like half of that. We can figure some of that. It hasn't been updated in well over a year. And
it could just be a matter of who...
I feel like now I think we should update it.
All right.
Yeah.
So anyway, by all means, check us out online. We are at facebook.com/ghosthuntinginNewEngland, Instagram, Ghost Hunting in New England. Yep. How do you like to say the one with the little Tweety bird?
Twitter at ghosthuntingNE.
You can
find us at ghosthuntinginnewengland.com, which hopefully I will try to keep my word as best I can and start updating it. Last time, I think I was on it today. The last time it was updated was when we had numismatist David Ray on the show. And that was a fantastic episode. He was a lot of fun. But we got to update it from there. So we're going to go ahead and try to get that done. Please leave us a 5-star review. That is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 stars. Don't leave us a 1-star review.
That's just rude.
It's so rude. It's gross. Ugh.
You know what else is gross?
What?
When people are in a restaurant and they take their shoes off.
Bad taste. Don't do it.
Oh, no. I had to look at someone's feet while I ate lunch today. Mm. And if you think for 1 second I could look away from the feet, I couldn't. It's not like it's the middle of summer and they weren't wearing flip-flops. It is winter. It is snowing. They had boots. And they took their feet out of their boots and they did not have socks on. So the moral of my story is keep your shoes on in a restaurant.
There you go. You heard it here first, folks.
And give us a 5-star review.
And a 5-star review. And as always,
happy hunting.